Hey, sex fans, welcome back. Today is Wednesday, January 19th, 2011, and you are lucky enough to be listening to the podcast edition of Dr. Dick's Sex Advice with an Edge, with your host, that savagely scintillating sexologist, Dr. Dick. That's me. Oh my God, I am all aflutter, sex fans. I feel like the most popular boy in school just asked me to the prom. So, okay, maybe that's a bit of an exaggeration. It's more like the most popular boy in school just told me that he wants to bugger me senseless. No, wait. This isn't coming out precisely as I hoped. Let's just say that I am thrilled to overflowing to have today's guest join me for this Sex Wisdom podcast. As you know, this series is all about talking with people who are changing the way we look at our sexual selves. And no one in this series so far has exceeded the impact of today's guest on that discourse. I have the honor of welcoming psychologist Christopher Ryan, co-author of Sex at Dawn, The Prehistoric Origins of Modern Sexuality. I confess, this book simply blew me away. And that's pretty hard to do considering I'm such a jaded old queen. But honestly, I can't remember being so impacted by anything I've read on the topic of human sexuality in, ever. Sex at Dawn is nothing short of revolutionary. Despite this being a scholarly work, Christopher and his wife, Gisilda Jetha, have gone out of their way to make their presentation completely accessible even to a layman. There's nothing pretentious about it. The book is full of humor and fascinating anecdotes, but I can assure you that it will reshape how you look at your own sexuality. Christopher invites you to learn more about Sex at Dawn by visiting their site, sexatdawn.com, of course. You can also find him on Facebook, and don't miss his enlightening Twitter feed, @sexatdawn, don't you know? Today's program is brought to you by DrDickSexAdvice.com and DrDickSexToyReviews.com. That's right, sex fans. Our sponsor today is me. You'll have to excuse the shameless self-promotion, but I wanted to call your attention to the standing invitation for everyone in my audience to support and underwrite these marvelous shows. I'm exceptionally proud of the quality programming I've been bringing you, my international audience. Over the last 4 years, I've presented a variety of extraordinarily informative, enriching, and entertaining shows, interesting interviews, enlightening Q&A, and even some fun product reviews. I mean, where else can you find this sort of diverse sex-positive programming? And all of this always comes to you absolutely free. Okay, so right about now you're probably asking yourself, hey, Dr. Dick, how can I help support and underwrite this effort? Well, I'll tell you. Just mosey on over to either one of my sites, DrDickSexAdvice.com or DrDickSexToyReviews.com, and look for the donate button. It's a blue heart-shaped icon. Click on it and make your contribution. Any amount will do. But those folks who are donating $50 or more will receive a swell thank you gift, excellent personal lube, smutty porn DVDs, wonderful sex toys, or some delicious erotica. Be the first one on your block to join me in bringing the world this fun, informative, and enlightening programming. And now that I'm processing donations with PayPal, it's even easier than before to make your contribution. Okay, on with the show. Welcome, Christopher, and thank you for taking time out of your exhausting book tour to come schmooze with me for this Sex Wisdom podcast. I know that our little get-together has been long in the making, since early October, actually, so I'm all the more stoked that we are finally able to make this happen. So now that you're finally here, would you like to say hello to all the nice people?
Hello, everybody. Good to be here.
Good. So, speaking of your exhausting book tour, how does it feel to finally settle back home and be with your lovely wife and co-author, Gisilda Jetha? Is she glad to have you back? Were there cookies waiting?
I guess she's moderately glad to have me back, yeah.
Are you a pain in the ass or what?
No, but I think she enjoyed her time
right.
by herself.
Right.
Well, not by herself, her and three cats.
Oh, right. Well, there you have it.
Yeah, I'm the male human presence in the house, which can be disruptive.
It's so disruptive, isn't it?
Yeah, it can be.
So your recent travels brought you predominantly to the United States, right? Did you get to Canada at all?
No, I didn't on this trip. It seemed that I was going to be going to Vancouver, but that got canceled at the last minute. So primarily the West Coast, Chicago, and New York.
Uh-huh. I'd love to hear some of your reflections on the response that you received here in the U.S. as you traveled about. Your book is very controversial. Were you met by any hostility? And how did the media treat you and it?
Well, to be honest, we haven't seen the sort of hostility that we were expecting or even hoping for,
you
might
right?
say.
Right, yes, exactly, for, you know, to stir up book sales, for sure.
Right. When I was in Los Angeles, I met with some publicists and movie people, and there's a lot of interest coming from Hollywood. And interestingly, one of the things that one of the publicists I met with sort of recommended was that we intentionally stir up
no
more.
Right.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
Hollywood. So unlike the Hollywood folk.
Yeah. I mean, he was saying, you know, unless you can provoke Fox News to come out and attack you, you're not going to be able to
right.
take this to the next level, which is probably true. But the things he wanted me to say and get involved with just
yeah.
didn't make sense for me.
Right.
I don't,
right.
you know, I think a lot of the question comes down to whether or not the book is prescriptive.
Right.
And, you know, Casilda and I made a very conscious choice to avoid any sort of advice giving in the book.
Right.
And so that seems to be a line in the sand where on the one side you have people, many, many readers actually have written to us to thank us for not taking it that further step and saying, therefore, here's what a functional marriage would look like, or marriage is a crock and nobody should even try it, or,
right.
you know, whatever particular conclusion. But the commercial interests really want us to do that. So it's very interesting to see those two things in conflict.
Well, it's true. I mean, because the popular culture almost demands that there be a solution to absolutely everything, you know, and a quick solution, you know, and if it can be, you know, administered in a pill form, all the better.
It's
shocking. It's absolutely shocking. And, you know, and I'm going to write this book for you, and I'm going to digest it for you, and I'm going to spew out, you know, what I think is pablum that you can accept and abide by. And there's no, you know, opportunity for the reader to make conclusions on his or her own. I mean, it's shocking the way the industry expects it to go these days.
Yeah, and you're right. It's a very endemic in American culture, this sense that if you identify a problem, you are obligated to offer a solution.
Right.
So, if I wrote a book proving that cell phones cause brain cancer, then am I also required to come up with a whole new system of cell phone transmission?
Right,
you know,
exactly that.
It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
It's a cognitive mistake. And if you look at what I would say is probably the most famous example of that would be Karl Marx, you know, where
mm-hmm.
he initially did a brilliant analysis of capitalism and showed how capitalism worked and why it didn't work and, you know, how easy it is to be abused and so on and so forth. That was great. But then when he started recommending how to organize societies,
right.
you
That's
know,
where it all fell apart.
Yeah. And the problem with that is now communism is so discredited that it's almost forbidden to talk about the fact that Marxism in terms of analysis is still the most brilliant analysis of capitalism there is.
Right.
So it's a shame, you know, that he took that further step, because really, if you're doing a critique, it's not incumbent upon you to offer alternatives.
And had you and Casilda done that, then, you know, the attack would be, you know, for your advice and not for the brilliant, you know, science that you lay out.
Well, thank you. Yeah, that you're right. That would attract all the attention away from the science.
Right.
And what we really wanted to do was just say, look at this science. This is a very solid interpretation of human sexual evolution that explains so much about the way we feel and experience our daily lives, that it would be a shame to distract from that with whatever particular perspective she and I would bring to it, which is no more valid than anyone else's, really.
Yes.
So,
and whatever solution you might come to, it may not necessarily be applicable to anyone else.
Yeah, it's very very difficult to make any sort of blanket statements on what sort of relationship can work for people without taking into consideration their very individual situations, not only of each person individually, but of the relationship.
Exactly.
You know, what stage of life are they in? They have children together. Do they have business together? Is there a lot of money involved? You know, are their sexual appetites very different, or do they complement each other well? There's so many different variables Silda and I really don't feel that a book is a place to be giving anyone any advice about things like this.
Yeah. It's interesting because you have some pretty harsh words for those of us in the advice-giving business, and rightfully so. I have my own quarrels with a lot of my peers, both amateurs and professionals, because I think we're doing things wrong. We have an idea that everyone needs to fit within the confines of a happy marriage, a sexually exclusive, happy marriage, and we're going to do everything in our power to make that fit everyone. And I think that's a wrong place to start.
Yeah, I agree. I think that probably the most common intellectual mistake we make is the failure to question the premise.
Right.
You know, it's the easiest way to trap someone in a debate is to just throw out a premise and get them talking before they've had a chance to really question it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what's happened in the therapeutic community to a large extent, where they've accepted the premise that long-term sexually exclusive monogamy is the normal default human situation.
Right.
And as we demonstrate in Sex at Dawn, that's questionable at best.
Right.
And what happens is that once you accept that premise, then all the difficulties that people have in maintaining that sort of situation are dismissed as psychopathology or immaturity or a fear of commitment or what have you. And that's the harsh words that we have for therapeutic community are really centered on that, on the pathologizing of pretty much unavoidable feelings and to some extent behavior, which we see as being very analogous to the way masturbation was pathologized.
Exactly that. Exactly that.
Or female sexual desire in any expression, or you're a witch, you're a whore, you're a wanton slut if you're a woman who has any sort of sexual hunger at all. We outline that in the book in a couple of chapters where it's so important to understand, once you accept the fact that human beings are extremely libidinous apes who are also highly intelligent, then masturbation, wet dreams, sexual fantasies, and so on are no longer pathological and something to be cured. They're something to be understood as part of the package of being a human being.
Right. But it's, as you suggest, that it's a long time in coming. I mean, for many centuries, it's been pathology. And, you know, we've tried to drum it out, beat it out, religion it out of humankind, and not overly successful, made lots of very unhappy, unhealthy, crippled personalities in the process.
Sure, not to mention the people that were thrown in the river and drowned to death, or
burned at the stake. Exactly,
at the stake, or even today, you know, women who are being stoned to death in the desert,
yes,
because they had sex with someone of their choosing,
yes,
as opposed to the person that their family chose for,
yes,
them, or the fact that they were raped.
Yes.
You know, that the woman's killed because she's considered worthless because she's no longer a virgin.
Right.
You know, this sort of thinking is very deep in Western society, but what we try to demonstrate in Sex at Dawn is that it's not human nature.
Right.
That's the important key, that this sort of sick understanding of female libido is not human nature, and there's no evidence that it is human nature, despite many claims to the contrary.
So let's then get to the main thesis of your book that we've been dancing around here for a bit. You contend that humankind is not hardwired for sexual exclusivity or even monogamy, and you base this thesis on numerous data that come from several scientific disciplines. That's correct, yes?
Sure.
So how did we get it so wrong for so long? Have our cultural prejudices gotten in the way of seeing what is really there?
Well, that's what cultural prejudices do best, right?
Yes.
That's what they're for.
Don't look at the little man behind the curtain.
Yes, exactly. The problem, one of the things that Sigmund Freud got right, in my opinion, is that he understood the extent to which Western civilization is directly related to the repression of human sexuality.
Right.
So if you look at civilization and its discontents, that's his central argument, that all this flourishing of arts and science and technology and everything we've got, the good and the bad, is in some ways directly related to the repression of human sexuality. Because if, you know, and I think what he's really pointing toward, maybe without really understanding it, is not just sexuality, but the pre-agricultural human lifestyle,
uh-huh,
which was characterized by a very free sexuality, certainly compared to what we have now.
Right.
And a lack of what we might call the work ethic. So, you know, hunter-gatherers lived for anywhere from a couple million years to a couple hundred thousand years, depending on how you want to define people,
uh-huh,
without really coming up with much other than a bow and arrow and you know, a quick and easy way to live, to build a shelter and trap animals and so on. But they didn't come up with a lot of technology or what we might call advances. And the argument has sort of been like, well, why didn't they? Why weren't they intelligent enough to come up with these technological advances? What Casilla and I try to do in the book is flip that over and say, well, why would they?
Mm-hmm.
Because all the evidence points to quite satisfying, relaxing life of plenty for most of our human ancestors before agriculture.
Right.
So the idea that agriculture represents a big leap forward for human beings is, we argue, completely mistaken and 180 degrees from the reality. The reason people didn't invent a lot of stuff 50 to 100,000 years ago is because they weren't lacking. You know, we say necessity is the mother of invention. Well, you know, they didn't need anything else.
Right.
So, you know, readers and listeners of the podcast can look to the book for the examples, but, you know, we make a pretty detailed argument that pre-agriculture human beings had it pretty good. contrary to the nasty, brutish, and short cliche that we've all grown up hearing about.
And but, one of the things that I would like to clarify for a lot of the people in our audience, myself included before I read the book, is I didn't realize the extent of prehistory, and that there were hundreds of thousands of years before, you know, that we humans, you know, walked the earth and, you know, were doing our thing before the advent of agriculture. And agriculture and its after effect or history is something quite recent.
Yeah, if you take the most common definition of human beings, which is anatomically modern humans who had the brain architecture just like ours, same size brain, same body anatomy, presumably language, certainly had control of fire, tool use, there's evidence of artistic expression and so on, you're looking at 200,000 years.
Wow.
So that's a very conservative definition of how long human beings, that's us, not our sort of proto-hominid ancestors, but we're not talking about apes, we're talking about human beings.
Right.
200,000 years. Agriculture at its earliest was 10,000 years. So that's 5% of our existence. And of course, agriculture still hadn't spread to most of the planet 200 years ago.
Right.
So you're looking at a very thin veneer on total human experience happening in the historical period, which is after agriculture. Hmm. So yeah, that's very important to understand. And you're right, most people don't think in those terms. They think, you know, the Romans and the Greeks were a long, long time ago, and that was sort of the beginning of it all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was the beginning 3,000 years ago, was the beginning of what we consider Western civilization, but it certainly wasn't the beginning of human experience.
Right.
So if you want to understand human experience and the environment in which human beings evolved, and of course evolution is a dance within environment, it's a interactive
right.
experience between an organism and its environment. So in order to understand an organism, you really have to look at the environment in which it evolved.
Right.
And our ancestors evolved in a nomadic hunter-gatherer existence on a nearly empty planet in terms of human habitation. So it wasn't at all the overcrowded struggle for survival kind of planet that the Hobbesian view assumes.
Right. So one of the things, if we are caught misunderstanding the evolution of humankind and our prehistory as well as our history, we're going to come up with, as you say, the dominant cultural narrative of human sexual evolution that is wrong. The idea that human nature for females is to trade sexual fidelity for the things that males can provide, like food and protection, etc. It's a relatively new dynamic in human behavior that you've just explained. And so to claim that it's a byproduct of the switch from hunting and gathering to agriculture is it's more clear if one understands it historically.
Yeah, I think so. And the evidence for that is copious. If you look at, I mean, what we try to do in the book is to really delineate the two very different sorts of lives that existed for human beings, pre-agriculture and post-agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just a question of where your food comes from. It involves how you relate to other people, political hierarchies, the amount of violence in your society, the amount of disease, really basic issues in everyday life. And what happened was, before agriculture, you have societies that are centered on the notion of commonality, of shared experience, of shared responsibility, of unanimity in making decisions, and a lack of coercive power. It's sort of axiomatic among anthropologists that it's very hard to coerce a hunter-gatherer. You can't make them do anything. They refuse to be told what to do. They're extremely autonomous. And it seems sort of ironic or counterintuitive from our perspective, because on one side we're saying they've got this very almost communistic view of their society, where they're so interdependent and they take care of each other's kids and they share the food and they share everything. But on the other side, they're individually very autonomous. The reason for that is that they all have independent access to the necessities of life. So every hunter-gatherer, just like chimps and bonobos, our two closest primate relatives, can get what they need independently. They don't need anyone's permission to find food or to build shelter or whatever else they need. So there's no coercive power, as we see in post-agricultural societies, where someone is controlling the harvest and controlling the distribution of wealth.
So some people would say that if this is true, if this worldview is true, shouldn't there be some remnants of this kind of behavior today that we can look at and see what our life must have been?
Sure, there are lots of remnants, ranging from those few existing hunter-gatherer societies that haven't yet been contaminated by Christianity and capitalism and the rest of it, which exemplify this sharing-based social system that I described earlier, ranging to the way we treat our friend. You know, according to sort of classic evolutionary theory, we shouldn't really be doing anything for anyone who's not related to us.
Right.
You know, unless altruism is a huge mystery for economic theory. But, you know, it gives us pleasure to help our friends.
Yes.
You know? And in fact, it even gives us pleasure to help complete strangers. We do it all the time through, you know, sending money to Haiti or whatever it is. It touches something in us to help somebody who needs help. And, you know, there's nothing, talking about all this, I want to make sure people understand, we're not talking about noble savages. We're
exactly
not romanticizing others. We're simply saying that for most of our existence as a species, the most efficient way of surviving was to take care of each other.
Right.
That was just the best way of spreading risk. It was the best way of assuring ourselves of a meal every day. It doesn't make sense to live as the conventional evolutionary theory predicts. It doesn't make sense for me to go hunting, kill a deer, bring the deer back to the village, share it only with my wife and my kids. That doesn't make any sense at all. First of all, there's no refrigeration. So what am I going to do with the rest of the deer?
Exactly.
Save it for next week and eat rotten meat? That doesn't make sense. Secondly, what's it going to do to group cohesion for me to be sitting there with a deer that I'm not sharing with anyone while other people in the village are hungry?
Exactly.
That doesn't make sense. And how does it benefit me for my children to survive while yours die? It's just the classic evolutionary theory is so deeply contaminated with Victorian capitalistic assumptions that haven't been sufficiently questioned. Earlier we talked about questioning the premise,
right,
you know, before you get into the debate. I think we really need to question some of the assumptions in these theories before we accept the conclusions. And one of the most glaringly, obviously wrong presumptions is that human beings evolved in nuclear families as economic units, as sexually exclusive units.
Right. There's so can I ask then, in terms of these hunter-gatherer societies that are still left on the planet and the evidence that we have from people that encountered them, you know, hundreds of years ago, can we say then that they must have had a different appreciation to sex and sexuality than we do, in the same way that they had a different appreciation of, you know, how to share food and, you know, work together as a unit?
Yes, exactly. And the evidence for that is everywhere. You look at, as I said, if you look at the anthropological studies of existing hunter-gatherers that we talk about in our book, or you look at accounts of first contact between, you know, Captain Cook and various island people in the South Pacific, for example, the Hawaiians and Tahiti and various places. You look at the accounts sent back even by Jesuit missionaries in Canada and various parts of the United States. You look at the accounts of the mountain men, although most of them weren't literate, so you don't get a lot of written accounts from them in the West. But if you look at all these sources of information, it's universal that first contact between Westerners and hunter-gatherer people, the Westerners mainly being Christian, are blown away by the sexual freedom of the people they encounter.
Right. Even appalling. You
know, well, yeah, exactly. It's appalling, but you know, it's interesting. If you look at the letter that Columbus wrote back to the king and queen upon his first encounter with people in Hispaniola, it's a very striking letter. He says that the people are physically beautiful, very healthy. That if you express admiration for anything, they just give it to you without even thinking about it. So there's your generosity and your sharing motif. And that the women, they all go about naked with just a little something covering their genitals. And there's food everywhere, fruit in the trees and fish in the water. And he ends by saying, "This must surely be paradise." And then he says, "With 100 soldiers, I could control the entire island."
It's so true. I mean, talk about clash of cultures. Ways of thinking.
They paved paradise
and put up a parking lot. Gosh, it's so true. So the long and the short of it is that this clash continues. Does it not? I mean, we are continually fighting ourselves, both inside of ourselves and outside of ourselves, to kind of buckle down to what the culture wants us to be.
Right. You know, you asked about echoes. There are echoes of this same clash of cultures in the Republican and the Democratic Party in the U.S.
Right.
Right? You see the Republicans who are saying, No, everything works really well in a zero-sum, winner-take-all system. And you see the Democrats saying, no, we need to take care of each other. We need to share the wealth. You know, we need to have some sort of safety net. Those are all pre-agricultural human values. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in Sex at Dawn, we talk about a very poignant situation where I think it was Montaigne, the French philosopher, who wrote about how some explorers brought back a few Indians that they'd captured them or they came willingly, but they were brought back to France to meet the king, and they toured France, and Montaigne was lucky enough to meet them, and in the conversation with them, he asked them what was their greatest impression of Europe and European society and so on. And they said that they were most amazed that A man could be fat and have more food than he could possibly eat while his neighbors starved to death. And they just could not understand how that could happen without him having his house burned down immediately.
It's amazing.
Because in their society, such a thing would have been unthinkable.
Right.
And this is a problem that anthropologists run into when they go to live with hunter-gatherer people. They'll tell you about stories where they show up and they're welcomed, and yet the people get very confused by the fact that the anthropologist has brought a big trunk full of food and gadgets and cameras and tape recorders that he won't let them share.
Right.
And yet they're expected to share their lives with him and their food with him and tell him all their family secrets, but he won't even share his peanut butter. And so that often is a big problem.
I know. Isn't it amazing? And what if the shoe was on the other foot? What if, you know, the hunter-gatherers were the, you know, anthropologists, you know, the dominant culture, and they were studying us, you know, as some kind of freakish kind of thing that they were completely unfamiliar with, and, you know, said the very kind of things that the Indians said to Montaigne. I mean, it just, how could you live like this? And wouldn't they want to stamp it out, you know, in much the same way as the, you know, Christian missionaries wanted to stamp out the sexual freedom of the indigenous people that they encountered?
Well, that's a very interesting idea. It'd be a great movie, huh? But the thing is that the hunter-gatherer mentality would probably preclude them wanting to stamp it out, because
yes,
their approach to things they don't agree with is to walk away from it.
Interesting.
You know, they're not interested in general in coercing anyone else to accept their point of view. If you don't share their point of view, they'll argue the point of view, but then if you know, you're not convinced, then that's it. You're not convinced. Hmm. So that's why the notion of leadership in a hunter-gatherer society is very different from what we understand it to be in our societies. Hmm. And why there's always so much confusion when you read accounts of this first contact, you know, where the Westerners show up and they want to buy Manhattan Island, or they want to buy the Black Hills or whatever.
Right.
You know, the Indians, first of all, they don't have the concept of land ownership, so they don't really know what the hell they're talking about. And, you know, and when the whites say, well, who's in charge? You know, take us to your leader. Well, what leader? There are lots of different leaders.
Mm-hmm.
Just like in your group of friends, which we might say is another echo of a tribe. We all have, you know, communal groups that we live in that may not even be physically in the same place, but we've got up to 150 people that we relate to and that we keep track of on a personal level in our lives. Well, who's the leader of that group? You know, if you're talking, if someone needs help with you know, a sexual issue or a relationship issue, maybe you're the leader of that group.
Exactly.
But if someone needs some legal advice or some business advice or, you know, medical advice, then presumably you're not that leader. And that's the way it works in hunter-gatherer societies. Different people are considered leaders in different capacities simply because they're respected. Certainly not because they consider themselves to be leaders.
Right.
Leadership is a function of admiration in hunter-gatherer societies.
Hmm.
So, it's very, very different from post-agricultural, hierarchical, top-down political organization.
And with that, I'm looking at my clock and I see that we are over time for today. And yet I have so much more that I want to talk to you about. Your book is chock full of fascinating things that I would like to discuss. Is it possible for you to come back next week?
Sure, I'd be happy to.
Oh, yippee. But before we go, would you give us your website address and walk us around a bit? And where can we buy your book?
Well, the website is sexatdawn.com, and there's a link there where you can buy the book directly from our website, or you can check a local bookstore and see if they've got it. I'd probably recommend you give them a call first, because a lot of them don't carry it, unfortunately. But they'll certainly order it for you if you prefer to send your money to them rather than Amazon.
Right.
And there are excerpts, quite a bit of excerpts on our website that people can look at, as well as the entire reference section. So scholars or grad students or whomever can take a look and see what's there before they buy the book.
Good. And you are also on Facebook, and you're a Twitter kind of guy too, right?
Well, I'm not a Twitter kind of guy, but I do it under duress.
I follow you, and I love it. So until we meet again next week, we will be visiting with you in cyberspace.
All right, great. Thanks,
Christopher. Bye. What a terrific show. Well, that's it for today, Sex fans. Tune in next week at this time for part two of my conversation with Christopher Ryan and more Sex Advice with an Edge with your host, me, Dr. Dick. Again, this week's podcast sponsor is Dr. Dick's Sex Advice and Dr. Dick's Sex Toy Reviews. Simply put, I need your help to continue to provide shows like the one we just heard. But you may be asking yourself, hey, why should I make a donation? Well, I'll tell you. Infrastructure and administration costs for a free site like this are astronomical. So if you like what you see and hear, if you enjoy all the wonderful features of DrDickSexAdvice.com and DrDickSexToyReviews.com, then I invite you to make a modest one-time donation online. We suggest a donation between $20 and $50, but any amount will be gladly accepted. This is a one-time donation. There are no automatic credit card renewals or processing fees, and you can be certain that every dime you donate will go to supporting this valuable sex-positive effort. Finally, your donation underscores your social conscience. Your sponsorship helps disseminate badly needed sex education and sexual enrichment messages throughout the entire world. I thank you in advance for your generosity. Until next time, remember, sex is good. And good sex? Why, that's even better. Over and out.